headlines this hour. Israeli authorities announce a plan to build 930 new settler units on occupied Palestinian land northeast of Jerusalem al-Quds. Russia's foreign minister warns that Moscow will retaliate it in U.S. sanctions against the country over jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Plus, official data shows the number of jobless people in Spain reached 4 million in February, as coronavirus-related restrictions ravaged the ailing economy. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Israeli authorities have reportedly approved the construction of 930 new settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. According to Palestinian media reports, the new units will be built in an area northeast of Jerusalem al-Quds. All Israeli settlements built on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Several UN resolutions have also called for a halt to the projects. The Israeli regime, however, has been pressing ahead with expanding its settlements over the past years. Palestinians are outraged at the projects and see them as a main hurdle to resolve their decades-long conflict with Israel. A U.S. military convoy has been targeted in the central Iraqi province of Babil. Iraqi sources say the convoy, carrying logistical equipment, was targeted with a roadside bomb in the city of Al-Hilla. No casualty or damage was reported. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly been targeted in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Anger mounted after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in January of last year. Iran has called for an end to the sales of weapons used to kill innocent people in Yemen. Iran's permanent representative to the U.N. office in Geneva also demanded an end to the blockade and military intervention in Yemen. Ismail Baghaei Hamaneh said action should be taken to facilitate the dispatch of aid to Yemenis. The country has been devastated by a Saudi-led war that began 6 years ago. On Monday, the UN warned of a, quote, death sentence for Yemen, as a donor conference yielded only less than half the funds needed to prevent a devastating famine. The UN has already warned that some 16 million Yemenis will go hungry this year. Yemen's city of Ma'arib has witnessed fighting between Ansarullah members and Saudi-backed militants since early February. Scores of people have been killed on both sides. The fighting comes as the Saudi-led coalition continues its airstrikes on Yemen. The attacks, coupled with the COVID-19 pandemic, have worsened the already dire humanitarian situation in that country. Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president Abu Rabah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeida. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeida, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeida. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the sixth anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led war in Yemen has worsened the country's famine-like conditions. That has raised concerns among UN agencies that millions of people could lose their lives. Roughly about 16 to 17 million people or Yemenis are food insecure. Over 100,000 have been killed, and more than 2 million have been internally displaced as a result of the Saudi war. The kingdom has been bombing Yemen almost on a daily basis since March 2015. Attacks have devastated the country and destroyed much of its infrastructure. War crimes have been documented also. Even though the U.S. has said it would not support this war militarily, it still continues to provide the Saudis with what it calls defensive weapons. And just recently, the U.S. said that it would evaluate arms sales on a case-by-case basis. The U.N.'s humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered the Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse, as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country. Iran warns against efforts to pass a resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency on the 2015 nuclear deal, saying that such a move would be counterproductive. The Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs slammed the European signatories for not complying with their commitments under the deal. Abbas Araghchi added that any anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting would harm diplomatic efforts, especially after the recent inspection deal between Tehran and the UN agency. He also reiterated that Iran would only resume its full compliance with the nuclear deal when illegal sanctions against the country are lifted.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. I'm Homa Lizgi in Vienna.
Russia warns that any U.S. sanctions over the case of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny are ineffective. The Kremlin warned that sanctions will further strain relations with Washington. This came after media reports said the U.S. is planning new measures against Russia for its alleged role in Navalny's poisoning. Moscow denies any involvement, saying that it has seen no proof that he was poisoned. The Kremlin critic has been in prison since mid-January after his return from Germany. There he was receiving treatment after the poisoning incident. Last month, a Russian court gave him 2.5 years in jail for violating the terms of an earlier suspended sentence. Marina Kurtanova says that the U.S. might target Russian officials and firms with new sanctions over the Navalny case.
Washington will impose sanctions today on March the 2nd. And according to the sources, Washington will impose sanctions under the 1991 Chemical and Biological Weapons Control Act and two executive orders. One of them was signed after the reunification of Crimea with Russia 7 years ago in 2014, and it provides for the possibility of imposing sanctions on Russian officials, their persecution. And the second concerns the fight against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Both documents allow the United States to freeze the American assets of those targeted by sanctions and effectively prohibit American companies and individuals from doing business with them. Yesterday, on Monday, the first ambassadors of the 27 EU member states agreed on sanctions over the Navalny case, and those associated with his conviction will be subject to them. And Russia has promised to respond to EU sanctions and pointed out that they are illegal and dead-end way of interaction with Moscow. There will be a reaction, but authorities did not specify which one.
Official data shows the number of jobless people in Spain has hit 4 million in February. The data provided by the Labor Ministry shows that jobless claims rose by 1.12% from a month earlier. This is the highest unemployment rate since the year 2016. February was also the first month of net job destruction in Spain since May of last year. Officials have blamed the rise of unemployment on coronavirus restrictions. They say that the new data reflects the structural flaws of the labor market that are heightened by the pandemic. Germany's exports to Britain have dropped considerably as demand is hurt by Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic. Official estimates show that Germany exported 30% less goods to the UK in January compared to a year ago. Statistics show that German exports to Britain have been declining since 2016, when the British voted to leave the EU. But the drop in demand sharply accelerated over the last year amid the pandemic. For 2020, German exports to Britain declined 15.5% compared to a year earlier. That marked the biggest drop on an annual basis since 2009. Meanwhile, German retail sales tumbled more than expected in January, partly due to COVID lockdowns. The British Chancellor will announce the country's annual budget for the year ahead. Wednesday's announcement will be Rishi Sunak's second since the pandemic began, and comes after a tumultuous year that saw sharp economic decline and rising redundancies across the UK, Saeed Purazar reports.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today, we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made Chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young Chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
And the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
A lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment, is literally their less than £400 a month. It's vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puruza, London.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report has revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known by his initials as MBS, has ordered and directed the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Press TV under the heading, Rights advocates decry Biden's decision against sanctioning bin Salman despite Khashoggi's report. Please stay with us for more of Press TV's article. Human rights advocates and U.S. congressional Democrats have decried the Biden administration's decision not to impose sanctions on Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, after a newly declassified American intelligence report confirmed that he had directly approved the assassination of U.S.-based dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Andrea Prasso, Deputy Washington Director of Human Rights Watch, said failure by President Joe Biden, who called Saudi Arabia a pariah state on the 2020 presidential campaign trail, to penalize Mohammed bin Salman was unconscionable. Andrea Prasso told the Middle East Eye News portal, "The fact that the U.S. has sanctioned so many of Mohammed bin Salman's associates, but not him, sends a terrible message that the higher up in a government you are, the more likely it is that you can commit crimes with impunity," Prasso added. "It also undermines America's credibility. It's hard to see what incentive Mohammed bin Salman has to alter his conduct, whether inside Saudi Arabia, in his conduct in the war in Yemen, or in other extraterritorial attacks on dissidents, when he knows he can literally get away with murder." Citing senior administration officials, the New York Times reported recently that President Joe Biden had decided that the diplomatic cost of penalizing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for ordering the hit on Jamal Khashoggi, a palace insider who later became a prominent critic of Mohammed bin Salman, would be too high. The decision came after weeks of debate in which Biden's new national security team advised the president against banning Mohammed bin Salman from entering the United States or considering criminal charges against Saudi Arabia's crown prince. According to the New York Times, White House officials pondering the matter have eventually reached a consensus that taking any action against the Saudi royals would be impossible without breaching the historically strong U.S. alliance with the oil-rich kingdom. The decision, which has already put Joe Biden's decision-making as president and his campaign promises into sharp relief, has disappointed human rights advocates and members of his own party, who had applauded Biden for making public the much-anticipated intelligence report on the Jamal Khashoggi murder case. Seth Binder, advocacy officer at the Project on Middle East Democracy, told Middle East Eye, "The Biden administration is trying to thread the needle. They want to continue to work with a partner that has committed a heinous act against a U.S. resident whilst taking some steps towards accountability." Seth Binder added, "But if human rights is really going to be at the center of U.S. foreign policy, as the administration has repeatedly claimed, then it can't give murderers a free pass." During his presidential campaign, Joe Biden promised to reassess America's relations with Saudi Arabia, which he said has no redeeming social value. Since taking office on 20th of January, Biden has suspended some arms sales to Riyadh and announced an end to Washington's support for the Saudi-led military aggression in Yemen. Still, many human rights advocates and members of Congress are demanding a more forceful approach to the oil-rich kingdom and to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who practically had carte blanche to carry out his aggressive domestic and foreign policy agenda during the 4 years of the presidency of Donald Trump. Raad Jarar, advocacy director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, said, "We're calling on the Biden administration to move ahead with accountability measures to sanction Mohammed bin Salman personally, along with everyone else who is implicated in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi." Human rights advocates had hoped that the Biden administration would, at a minimum, impose the same travel restrictions on Mohammed bin Salman that his predecessor Donald Trump had imposed on others involved in the murder plot. The newly declassified intelligence report from the Director of National Intelligence says Mohammed bin Salman, widely considered the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, directly approved the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who was lured into the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018 and brutally murdered inside the building by a Saudi hit squad. The report, which was submitted to the US Congress, said, "We assess that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved an operation in Istanbul, Turkey, to capture or kill Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi." Riyadh has strenuously denied any role by Mohammed bin Salman or other senior officials in the Khashoggi operation. It initially claimed that Jamal Khashoggi had left the consulate unharmed, but as international pressure mounted and the cover story began to collapse, it later said that the journalist had indeed been killed by a rogue group of operatives inside the Saudi consulate building. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats also urged President Joe Biden to impose sanctions on Mohammed bin Salman personally. Calling the release of the Khashoggi report a turning point in U.S.-Saudi ties, Representative Ilhan Omar said recently that she will be introducing legislation to penalize Saudi Arabia's crown prince. The Congresswoman Ilhan Omar said in a statement, "To this day, we continue to supply Saudi Arabia with U.S. arms that are used to commit human rights abuses around the world." The Muslim lawmaker from Minnesota added, "To this day, we still cooperate with the Saudi regime on defensive war efforts, including intelligence sharing. These must end, and there must be direct consequences for Mohammed bin Salman and his functionaries." Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, hailed the release of the intelligence assessment but said the Biden administration did not go far enough in holding the Saudi crown prince personally accountable. Adam Schiff said it was not acceptable to simply go after those who carried out the assassination, but not the leader who actually ordered the operation. Adam Schiff told CNN, "The report itself is pretty remarkable in saying, in no uncertain terms, that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia ordered the capture or killing of an American resident and journalist, that essentially the Crown Prince has blood on his hands." Senator Ron Wyden, who also underscored the need for Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to be penalized for his role in Khashoggi's murder, calling on the Biden administration to ensure the kingdom follows international laws. Senator Ron Wyden said in a statement, "By naming Mohammed bin Salman as the amoral murderer responsible for this heinous crime, the Biden-Harris administration is beginning to finally reassess America's relationship with Saudi Arabia and make clear that oil won't wash away blood." Denying that the administration was giving Saudi Arabia a pass, Biden's aides claimed that they were considering a series of new actions on lower-level Saudi officials intended to penalize the Saudi military and impose new measures against the kingdom for its human rights abuses. Those actions include a travel ban on Saudi Arabia's former intelligence chief, who was deeply involved in the Khashoggi operation, and on the Rapid Intervention Force, RIF, a unit of the Saudi Royal Guard that protects Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Trump administration acted against 17 members of that team, imposing travel bans and other penalties. In an apparent attempt to divert criticism from his decision not to punish Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, President Joe Biden said on Friday, 26th of February, that he would hold Saudi Arabia accountable. In an interview with Univision, Joe Biden detailed a conversation he had with Saudi Arabia's king, King Salman, in which he emphasized that the U.S. would push Riyadh to honor human rights amid lingering criticism over the Khashoggi case. President Biden said, "I spoke with the king and not the prince. I made it clear to him that the rules are changing and we're going to be announcing significant changes today and on Monday, 1st of March. We are going to hold them accountable for human rights abuses. The remarks came as bipartisan members of Congress called for a realignment of America's relationship with Saudi Arabia over the Jamal Khashoggi case and the Saudi-led offensive against Yemen, which, according to the United Nations, has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, allegedly to bring former Yemeni President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi back to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement in Yemen. However, the Ansarullah fighters have gone from strength to strength against the invaders, and significantly, they have been helped by the Yemeni army, leaving the Saudi-led coalition bogged down in Yemen. At least 80% of the population of 28 million Yemenis is reliant on aid to survive in what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Earlier this month, the United Nations agencies warned that about 400,000 Yemeni children aged under five are in danger of losing their lives this year because of acute malnutrition. The Saudi-imposed war has destroyed or closed half of Yemen's hospitals and clinics, leaving the people helpless, particularly at a time when they are in desperate need of medical supplies to fight the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Divine Trials. Why does Allah test? Well, the topic of divine trial is an issue of great debate and discussion. The first question that comes to mind is, are trials not for understanding matters which are obscure, hence eliminating our ignorance? If so, why does Allah, who possesses knowledge of the hidden and the manifest things within the heavens and the earth, have to examine and test the people? He already knows, right? His knowledge is unlimited. He has knowledge of every single possible thing that you can think of. So why would he try out the people? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up, correct? Well, does there exist something which is concealed from him and which may become manifest for him by the means of examination? In other words, does Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala stand in need of testing us and examining us before he gets to know what the outcome of it is going to be? Does he not have the knowledge of the unseen? Of course he does. So how do you add up these two things, right? On one hand, we are saying that Allah is trying us. Trying for what? So that he can find out about us, like whether we succeed or we fail, whether we pass or we fail. On the other hand, we are saying that his knowledge encompasses everything. So theoretically, he should already know what the outcome of that is going to be. Isn't that right? Many of our youth, they have this confusion in their head. They sometimes say it, sometimes they don't say it. But this is what goes through their head. We're going to try to answer this question right after this short break, so stay tuned. Welcome back to your listeners. So we were discussing about the trials and why does Allah feel the need to try us? Why does He take our tests and exams when we know that His knowledge is unlimited and is all-encompassing? So He should already know whether we are going to pass or fail a test, correct? To answer this, you know, the answer lies in fact that the concept of examination with respect to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is vastly different from that with respect to us. We are looking at the concept of examination in our context, not in the context of Allah. Our examinations are that which have been stated above, right? And we discuss this. That is, for a better comprehension and for clearing away ambiguity and ignorance, while the divine trials are, in reality, development and training. So when we test something, human beings, we test to find out something that we don't know. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tests its creatures and human beings, He tests them for the sake of their development and training. See how the objective of both the tests, they differ? The answer lies in the fact that the concept of examination with respect to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is vastly different from that with respect to us. Our examinations are, you know, what we discussed. So we need to completely take a different approach when we analyze this whole topic of divine trials and examinations and tests and tribulations that come from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He tests and tries the best of His servants. Why? Because He wants them to be the best and stay the best. Allah wants from them to improve themselves, develop themselves, and train themselves. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Trump extended the U.S. special relationship in the West Asia region with Israeli regime and Saudi Arabia. Biden continues this trajectory. Trump's provocative and illegal move of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds will not be reversed by Biden, nor will Palestinian rights be recognized. The new U.S. administration will be augmenting troops in Syria and expanding and building new military bases there, says Roger D. Harris, author, in an article published under the heading, Joe Biden Tells the World America is Back. Not that it ever really went anywhere. Stay tuned for more. America is back, President Joe Biden bellicosely proclaimed in his major foreign policy priorities speech at the Munich Security Conference on February 19th. Repeating it for effect, Biden signaled the end of the Trump interregnum. No more assuring words could have been uttered for George W. Bush's former defense secretary, Colin Powell, and the 7-yard Republican national security officials who had written an open letter endorsing Biden out of fear that Donald Trump would upset the bipartisan foreign policy consensus of regime change, forever wars, and the NATO alliance. Republican neocons now shelter in the Democrats' big tent, today's party of war. The major difference from his predecessor is that the new U.S. president promises a greater reliance on multilateral diplomacy and international cooperative agreements to achieve U.S. imperial goals. Where Trump withdrew the U.S. from the UN Human Rights Council 3 years ago, the U.S. will now re-engage as an observer. Regardless of the changing of the guard in Washington, the imperial goal of full-spectrum dominance endures from one administration to the next. The global network of up to 1,000 foreign military bases will not be shuttered. The new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, asserted that his policies would follow his predecessors, but will more effectively target official enemies such as Venezuela, and will double down on Russia. Following Trump, Biden is appealing to the UK High Court to extradite Julian Assange. Biden warned in his foreign policy priorities speech about competition among countries that threaten to divide the world caused by shifting global dynamics. The threat to divide the world that concerns the U.S. president is precisely any deviation from U.S. domination. Biden was referring to the emergence of potential rival powers. His warning affirms and extends Trump's 2017 National Security Strategy doctrine of great power competition and swings away from Barack Obama's earlier and subsequently abandoned conception of international interdependence. Biden's shifting global dynamics are what Obama's Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel referred to as challenging the world order that American leadership helped build after the Second World War. Biden's speech concluded, "We are at an inflection point caused by new crisis." While not identified by Biden, this is implicit recognition of impending crisis of legitimacy of the neoliberal world order. The U.S. is the main beneficiary, proponent, and enforcer of a global political economy that increasingly is seen as failing to meet people's needs. Class disparities are ever more evident in the U.S. and internationally during an economic recession. In the U.S., billionaires have added $4 trillion to their net worth since the onset of the pandemic. The U.S. mission in Iraq will be expanded and more U.S. troops will be sent to Germany. Biden justifies the NATO military encirclement of Russia with intimations that Ukraine and Georgia may eventually join by the threat from Russia, as they say. However, Russian reactions to staging hostile war games and nuclear capable facilities on its border are plausibly defensive. Meanwhile, the U.S.-led military alliance has long since broken loose from its Atlantic-centric borders, with NATO partners across the globe extending to Afghanistan, Australia, Colombia, Iraq, Japan, Republic of Korea, Mongolia, New Zealand, and Pakistan. The new administration will expand U.S. military presence in Africa through its Africa Command, AFRICOM, which in 2019 deployed special forces in 22 countries and was in active combat in at least 13 of them. The largest ever U.S. military exercise in Africa, African Alliance 21, is scheduled for June with partner nations. The U.S. continues to be the world's largest purveyor of military equipment, eclipsing the combined sales of the next four highest war profiteers. Trump extended the U.S. special relationship in the West Asia region with the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia. Biden continues this trajectory. Trump's provocative and illegal move of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds will not be reversed by Biden, nor will Palestinian rights be recognized. The new U.S. administration will be augmenting troops in Syria and expanding and building new military bases there. Biden announced that the U.S. will no longer support offensive operations in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has precipitated a human rights catastrophe. It remains to be seen what continuing lethal defensive aid to the Saudis entails. In response, the CEO of military merchant Raytheon commented, "Peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon." Joe Biden continues the illegal policy of regime change for Cuba of the previous 12 U.S. presidents. Covert and overt destabilization, blockade, and occupation of Guantanamo. It should be noted that Obama's openings to Cuba were not a deviation from previous policy, but an attempt to achieve regime change by different means. Biden has already deported thousands of immigrants back to Haiti and other countries. This represents a disappointing step backward from the Biden administration's earlier commitments to fully break from the harmful deportation policies of both the Trump and Obama presidency, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. U.S. foreign policy reflects the personal qualities of the person occupying the Oval Office. Party affiliation, and the constellation of states and corporate powers behind the administration. But eclipsing these factors are larger geopolitical developments, especially now with the emergence of China as the world's workshop. China's remarkable economic growth has been predicated on its integration into and indeed dependence on the international capitalist market, which is dominated by the U.S. Following Obama's pivot of Asia in 2012, Biden's policy portends a continuation of Trump's hostility toward China, only with further intensification. The U.S. military build-up to confine China includes land, air, sea, and even space forces, with the South China Sea as a hotspot of contention. The U.S. is ringing Russian China with missile defense systems, which had been illegal until George W. Bush abrogated the US, Russia, anti-ballistic missile ABM treaty in 2002. $1 trillion plus nuclear weapons modernization started by Obama and continued by Trump lurches on under Biden, with the entire US nuclear arsenal scheduled to be upgraded. The consequences are far greater risks of launching an accidental nuclear war and an accelerated arms race with Russia and China. The story ends just 100 seconds before disaster, but that is only half the story. The other half is the resistance to US imperialism. American leadership of the world, touted by both Republicans and Democrats, is not democratic. No one elected the US to be the world's nanny. International polls show the US is rated among the most feared, hated, and dangerous countries in the world, and the greatest threat to world peace. The Vox Populi Project reports majorities or pluralities of the U.S. people support reducing the military budget, achieving peace by avoiding foreign intervention, negotiating directly with adversaries to avoid military confrontation, decreasing U.S. troops overseas, and constraining the president's ability to attack a foreign adversary.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim. a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the hadith of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, in which he has narrated it to his companion or one of his close companions, Hisham ibn Hakam, we have reached the 21st section of this tradition. As most of you may have seen if you have been following the episodes of this tradition, the importance of the intellect, that is a faculty that we as human beings have been given, and we will surely be judged by it. If we have corrupted it ourselves, we'll be judged on that. If we have not used it, we have been judged on that. And so on and so forth. In this section of the tradition, the Imam alayhi salam is speaking about knowledge, understanding, and again action. That an action that is based on knowledge, on understanding, even though it is small, is far greater than an action that is just done for the sake of it. It's just done because so-and-so has said I should do it. No, there must be intellectual thought and understanding of why one is doing it, pondering upon it. And these actions and this servitude and obedience must lead one to ponder upon the greatness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or vice versa, the weakness of us. Where do we stand in this system of creation, and so on and so forth. So the Imam says that, O Hisham, a few good deeds from one with knowledge and one who uses his intellect is accepted. So basically a person performs a little, but that little that he does is performed, you know, with understanding of why he is doing it. That he's doing it in order to gain proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And not just as a parrot, and not just as dhikr, not just as a movement of, you know, his mouth. Even worse, not because of riyah, not because of showing off. And then the Imam continues and says that this action, even though small, is accepted and even at times will be multiplied. And then Imam continues, well, many good deeds from those who are ignorant and slaves to their desires are rejected. So here again we can see that on the flip side, if a person does so much, but he just does it because he thinks that, you know, people look at me and call me so and so and call me Abid and call me Alim and all these titles that I get, you know. Why are you doing it then? For example, we see certain individuals on certain nights, for example, the holy nights of Qadr, they just want to do the A'mal. They just want to do the du'as and the supplications. Yet they do not ponder and contemplate on the words of those supplications. It's important to complicate. It is important to contemplate and to ponder upon those words of the beautiful supplications of the A'imma alayhim salam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to do so, insha'Allah. Therefore we see that it is the quality of the action that is important and not the quantity. Insha'Allah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The
debate.